Paul studies, I hope I've got it right, the history of philosophy in Cambridge rather too many years ago, I suspect, and he wants to admit. And he's going to follow up talking about Popper and Kuhn. He's got a pre-prepared talk. Unfortunately, Trevor has already covered a little bit of what Paul is going to say, but bear with Paul on this. There is a handout through here with notes. When Phil comes to talk, Phil has specifically asked for his handout to go round after the talk. So I think maybe we'll do this with Paul's as well. Trevor didn't have an opportunity to get his talk photocopied. I've agreed with Trevor we can perhaps do things through the email service, because I would certainly like a copy of Trevor's talk.
Well, if you give me the file, then people can email me and ask them about, because I've got everyone's email address.
Yes.
Yeah. So if you just email me the script of talk, I'll send that to you. Yeah. Okay, but within the next few weeks, because I'll be on holiday. Yeah.
Okay, so we'll pass over to Paul now, if Alan's got the tapes
yeah.
all running. So here, I have to keep time going, and I'm going to change the slides. So, Paul.
Okay, good morning, everyone. I do apologise if I repeat a bit of what Trevor has said, but hopefully not too much. So I want to address the issue, in what sense does science progress? And I also talk about realism. With reference to two philosophers of science, Karl Popper and Thomas Kuhn. I'd like to set the scene a bit as Trevor did, so I think I might say very similar things, but I'm only dealing really with the 20th century, I think. So 50 to 60 years ago, it would have been generally accepted that science fell progress, and it would have been in a linear fashion. The atomic bombs had just been dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And in the first 50 years of the 20th century, the world of the atom had been opened up, quantum theory had been discovered, Einstein proposed his theory of relativity, the structure of DNA was unraveled in the 1950s. So science was going really well. Objective, theory could be tested experimentally to see if they were true or not, and scientific knowledge was increasing. Now, as Trevor said, the picture now is a bit different. And the rational nature of science is being questioned. So let's go back to the sort of 1920s to look at the work of the Vienna Circle, the logical positives such as Schlick and Carnot. And as Trevor said, they emphasised the principle of verifiability. What statements are true? What constitutes truth? Logical analysis was key to them, and they developed the work of Frege to derive a propositional calculus. The logical positives and imperatives held that we should be able to verify what statements are true, and Carnot tried to construct a theory-independent observational language. Science had to be based on empirical observation, and any metaphysics had to be banished. This ran into a number of problems, not least the problem of induction, which Trevor talked about. We cannot prove the statement, all swans are white. As an example. In science, we cannot say with certainty that the results of experiments we do now will be the same in the future. And that's a fundamental problem. Now, Karl Popper, who was quite vaguely attached to the Vienna Circle, proposed the falsification principle as a replacement for verifiability. So, one instance of a black swan will disprove the principle that all swans are white. And there's a basic asymmetry there. It takes only one instance to refute the theory, but even if we have thousands of confirmations in terms of white swans being discovered, it still does not prove conclusively that all swans are white. And history seems to show us we don't have external knowledge, even in science. Here is an example of this what Trevor mentioned, Newton's theory of time, space, motion and gravity, which were expanded and successful for 250 years, and yet they were overturned by Einstein's theory of relativity. Now Popper was very influenced by that, and he believed that we should always have the attitude that all theories might be wrong, So we test them to the limit. And he coined the phrase conjectural realism. And he wanted to define what methodology was science based on it. But as Trevor said, it didn't really work. There was no scientist actually following that methodology. But I still think that Popper's discovery of falsifiability is important. And it has actually occurred in the history of science in some instances. So although Popper thought induction irrational, he still thought there was progress in science based on this falsification principle. It was like a regulatory principle which kept science on track. You couldn't just oppose anything. And over time, Popper thought science was progressing by studying problems with ever-increasing depth. He was an interesting man. He also wrote a lot about the poverty of what he called historicism, which consists of trying to derive historical laws from studying history. He thought we can't really predict the future from the past, and that ties in with his views on induction as well. And in a sense, Kuhn, who I'll come on to later, was trying to do exactly that. So it's interesting that they do meet in that sense. He also had a theory of three basic entities in the world. World one entities were matter and forces, subject matter and physics. World two entities were psychological entities. And world three entities were products of the human mind. Now, I don't think there's a bit more about that, but it sounds interesting, but I won't go into it more. But one consequence of falsificationism for Popper was that things like Marxism, psychoanalysis, Freud and Jung were not really sciences, because you couldn't disprove them. It's too easy to adjust the theory, take account of new facts. Falsification, the ability to test theories and prove them wrong, Popper thought distinguishes science from non-science. There's something wrong with the theory that can't be tested. A good scientific theory, for Popper, would be a bold conjecture with consequences which could be tested in experiments. However, in the last 40 years, the social sciences have grown, and some would say pure science, as Popper envisioned it, and the logical positivists, has been diluted by social science. Concept science and rational knowledge has been under attack from these people called social constructivists. Now, this process was largely started, I believe, by the work of Thomas Kuhn, who published a remarkable book in 1963 called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. In this, he looked at the history of science, opposing somewhat to those existing views. He said there was no gradual change or progress. By looking mainly at Copernicus and the Einstein revolution, he attempted to show that established theories were simply overturned and replaced by new ones. In any scientific area, there was a pre-paradigm period, where a number of competing theories existed. And then perhaps after a major discovery, that area becomes mature, and a community of scientists exist, and they would agree on a particular set of theories. And Kuhn called the paradigm, which is a much maligned word, he didn't really define it very well, but I'll go into that a bit more. And then normal science would carry on, where the working out of the established paradigm would occur according to some sort of research program. But then anomalies would occur, things that the theory, the paradigm couldn't explain, and a new theory would have to be proposed to account for these. However, as Trevor said, that these competing theories were incommensurate. They couldn't be measured one against the other. And the consequence of that is that there's no rational process by which the right one, or a better one, could be chosen. As I said, Kuhn's use of this word paradigm was not very clearly defined. Basically, a theory is agreed by scientists, but Kuhn used it in a number of ways, particularly with regard to its scope. Sometimes it was a very large thing. It was a total world view, not just a scientific theory. And at other times it was much more limited. Now Kuhn tried to define it better, and he came up with a global sense of paradigm, which was meant to embrace all the shared beliefs and the values and the techniques that scientists use. but part of his global paradigm was a smaller paradigm, which he renamed Exemplus. It's a funny word, I suppose, but it basically comes rooted in an example that this is how you do science, this is how you do it in this particular field, this is the way you do it. So in his big paradigm, he saw it as a big disciplinary matrix which scientists would follow, and it consisted of these exemplars, which are what scientists learn at school, all the sort of ways of doing science. He had another four things that were interesting. There would be metaphysical beliefs, there were values such as simplicity, fruitfulness, accuracy, precision, consistency, breadth of scope. So all those are in Kuhn's philosophy of how to choose different theories. And then heuristic models, and lastly symbolic generalization. The thing I want to concentrate on is exemplars, because they're the most interesting thing. So those are used to train scientists in terms of what is a good solution to a problem. How do you tackle a problem? How should you solve it? And Kuhn enlightens them to cryptic crosswords. Doesn't sound very scientific. But he was emphasizing that some puzzles are not solved by simple rules. It's not logic. They're solved by intuition. So on this understanding, normal science uses exemplars to solve problems until anomalies are found, and then they're corrected by using these exemplars. But then you might get a situation where it's not possible to iron out the anomalies, and a crisis may develop, and a totally new exemplar is then needed. And this is revolutionary science. But he split science into normal and revolutionary science. And Popper and he disagreed. He thought normal science was quite valuable, but Popper seems to think that it was revolutionary science which was the valuable one, not the normal science. So because theories were incommensurable, social factors and values were key in determining the theory choice. And Kuhn hinted at something we all know, that scientists are ordinary human beings. They're politically motivated, they're open to corruption, keen to build power. So taken to extremes, it can be said that scientific theories are socially constructed, with little or no empirical basis. In fact, some would say that the empirical basis is just a smokescreen for scientists to wield power over communities. The truth of the theory is something that Kuhn said he can do without. He is just neutral about it. He believed that science progresses by more puzzles being solved, more of these exemplar puzzles. And he did also believe that these exemplars were rational. So in the end, it's a rational choice of theory which is made. But, you know, as I said before, he did have a lot of values as well as this rationalism. And scientific theories don't correspond to any real world. That's just unknown. So I think Kuhn left the door open for the social constructivist to say that the choice of theory is not rational. He's talked about these values, and he hasn't explained what the rational basis is. He said that theories can't be compared. So he left that door open, and psychological, social, political factors could play a part in how theories are chosen. And that is the hypothesis of the social constructivist, such as Law and Barnes, the people from the Edinburgh School. Just to sort of bring it up to date a bit, the scientific community can close ranks. And there's a couple of examples of that I'd like to give. It's just not open to new ideas. I was listening to Radio 4 the other day, and heard about the aquatic ape. Anyone heard of the aquatic ape theory of evolution? Yeah. So, this is an evolutionary theory which holds that human beings evolved from living on the seashore, rather than living on the African savannah and coming out from the forest into the savannah. there's various things that says that we can hold our breath underwater for a long time. We have a layer of fat under our skin which helps insulate us from the effects of cold water. And our mouth and our throat structure enable us to breathe through our mouths, which would help us in swimming. Now, I don't want to argue whether it's right or not. But what interested me was that the difficulty that proponents of this theory had putting it forward. The establishment, the evolutionary establishment, just wouldn't give them the time of day. And it was apparently an open and shut case that man evolved on the axis of God's manner, the way they said. Another example is one that Trevor mentioned, the theory of plate tectonics in geology.
Yes.
If you look at the history of geology, in the 1800s, rock strata was studied, and it was observed that rocks had apparently moved over time. And marine fossils were discovered high up in the mountains, far away from the sea. But there was no mechanism to explain these movements. Some geologists recognised that volcanoes and erosion were not enough to explain the large-scale movements which they could see. It was only in the 1950s, I think perhaps even earlier than that, that the theory of plate tectonics was put forth, and a credible mechanism was found for rocks to be moved large distances, and mountains to be created, and earthquakes to occur. These were all ultimately caused by tectonic plates some 50 kilometres down, moving and colliding with each other. Again, I don't want to argue the case of that plate tectonics, but the point is that it was initially ridiculed by the geological establishment, but they still did it as far as they. So, in terms of the history of science, if we focus a bit more into these theories following one another, it's not possible to say that successful theories are rational and hence true, and the unsuccessful ones are irrational and false. That's what the old-fashioned history of science looked like. Past scientists were disparaged for holding a belief which we now regard as false. And this is Kuhn's distinctive message, I think, of the history of historian as well. He found that when you entered into the overall worldview of past scientists, or as they were called then, natural philosophers, you could see that they were rational in their own terms, in their time. It's only because we inject modern-day beliefs into their theories, which they could not have had, that we make their ideas look odd and wrong. We cherry-pick the good ideas from the past we agree with and ignore the ones we disagree with. If we take the example of Copernicus, there were major problems with the proposal of the Earth to move around the Sun. And Ozzie Andrew, who wrote the preface to De Revolutionis, said that the heliocentric theory that the Earth revolved around the Sun was just saving the appearances. It wasn't true. I mean, how could it be in his world view? It contradicted prevailing Aristotelian views of mechanics and naturalistic Aristotelian place of matter in the universe. There was no alternative theory of mechanical motion which could support it at the time. If the Earth was moving, wouldn't everything be left behind in space? In fact, Copernicus thought that was, in some way, the violent consequences of the motion of the Earth could be contained by some natural Aristotelian force. But he was an astronomer, so he didn't say any more than that. He wasn't a physicist. And I don't think it was until the revolution in mechanics in Newton's time that you could say that a clearer explanation was given for how the Earth could move without all the objects on it coming off of it. I'd like to move on to Kuhn's theory of perception, which is very interesting. He thinks the changes in view that we have to have to move to a new paradigm, the science of gestalt psychology. As well as this, he denied, as Trevor said, that an independent observation language, observation is theory dependent, but no such thing as raw data. And observers see different things depending on their knowledge and how they interpret the data. What we see depends on our prior experience. It's difficult to change our view as our brain patterns are sort of hardwired. So Kuhn places a significant contribution to science on this mental component of perception. He treats science, scientific concepts, as a form of perception, allowing them to change. So he's like a sort of dynamic Kantian in that sense. We can't know, though, the world in itself, which seems to be the totality of the world. That's what he talks about. So his views, again, are tending towards social constructivism. In our perceptual knowledge, there seems to be an active mind constructing the world. And scientific knowledge seems to be that, written large. just have a look. I'm sure you've all seen this, but nice as well. Has anyone seen that? What can you see there? Let me see. Yes. Yeah. So it's a rabbit one way and a duck the other. Can you, have you all seen that? Yeah. Can you all see that? So it's one of these perception experiments where suddenly it will switch in your mind. You can see the rabbit.
Oh, yes, I do.
The rabbit is looking that way.
Yes. Let me ask the gesture.
So, rabbit's looking that way.
Yeah.
Now, there's also one here I've got, which is interesting.
Yeah, well, I don't know which way around that one goes.
What would you say that was? What people think that is? Can you see a... You see an antelope?
Yeah.
Antelope? If you turn it...
Who said it was a bird?
Oh, that way up.
Is
it
a bird?
Upside down.
Yeah. So, this in fact comes from some rock carving, which are meant to be 5,000 years old. And, you know, the people who showed them to me said that that was actually the point of it. You could switch the perception. So maybe this idea of you know, perception, these different words aren't so new as you think. Okay. Mm-hmm. So in the same way as that, you can make that switch to see things in different ways. Scientists in a particular community are sometimes not able to recognise a new theory. They can't make this switch. They can't see it. They're happier working within their established theoretical framework, where their skills and livelihoods lie. So Kuhn tends to treat theories as a whole, and a problem with this part is that the reputation of part of the theory would negate the whole theory. You see that as a whole, and that's the point of psychology. But you know, I think he was perhaps wrong there. Maybe we should try and identify what is the core part of the theory, but you don't fortify everything in the theory. So I think this idea of incommensurability doesn't quite rise. It's very interesting. So Kuhn doesn't go too far down the route of sceptical finitism, where things are so essentially because we reach a consensus, we agree. Perhaps more traditional view is that because things are as they are in the world, we then reach a consensus. And Kuhn tends to agree with that. He does think there are natural kinds or families, in the sense that Wittgenstein used the word. And he said an appropriately programmed perceptual mechanism to survival had survival values. In many environments, a group that could not tell wolves from dogs could not endure. And this is relevant to science, but may not be an obvious belief, that scientific theory pick out particular entities in the world. And he seems to agree that we can do that. So Kuhn accepted an external world, and he used the terminology of stimulus and sensation, where the sensation is our experience, which is subject-sided, related to what we experience, and the stimulus are part of the world in itself, outside us. So the same stimulus, the same perceived object, can have different sensations in our mind, and that's where you get the difference between two pictures. But he didn't believe in relativism in science, although I think his writings left the door open for that. But he did write a statement, which I object to. All past beliefs about nature have sooner or later turned out to be false. Now that is a very relativistic statement, and I think if we accept that statement, we really have thrown out most of what science is about. I'd just like to argue against it. We tend to think of the physical sciences as the paradigm of true scientific knowledge. And in fact, there are many different scientific areas. And scientific reasoning, I think, as Trevor hinted at, is complex and diverse. And perhaps we're hoodwinked by the success of physics as the paradigm of true scientific knowledge. You know, physicalism, I think, is still quite a popular philosophy, which holds that all phenomena are however complex they are, can be reduced to the laws of physics. It's got a long pedigree, that idea. It goes right back to the Greeks, and Descartes developed it in terms of mechanics. But acknowledging the different sciences, I would argue, is in fact stratified. Although living things are composed of atoms, it's behaviour of cells, specific organisation of those atoms, which govern much of biology. Biology, or maybe biochemistry, is based on the cell, plus the chemical processes going on in the cell. So that's a different level of explanation of physics. And biology also needs functional explanation. This is another science, chemistry. It's closely allied with this. It's based on the behaviour of atoms in chemical compounds, and it's possible, some believe, but it could be reduced in some way to physics. But if you look at something like the discovery of the elements of a periodic table, where the number of protons are balanced by the number of electrons for each element, and based on the measurable weight of the atom, I cannot see that that will ever be overthrown in some sort of scientific revolution. When there are smaller and smaller building blocks, obviously to atoms, but there is an entity, atom, at that particular size. It has specific concepts applied to it, and they work. And I believe not just incrementally, but they're really there, those atoms. So atoms can combine together to form chemical bonds, to form molecules. Chemical compounds react called the valency theory. Chemistry developed into other fields like organic chemistry, which Kepler developed. There's a study which develops from that, which is called stereochemistry, which is to do with the left-handedness and right-handedness of compounds, and it explains the behaviour of chemical reactions by that. So all that science, the historical research, tells us that Dalton's chemistry, organic chemistry, stereochemistry, they were all revolutionary paradigms in the sense that Kuhn's talking about. They led to lots of new research. Imagine a periodic table where people were slotting all the elements in over time. But there were also revolutions which were not built on the ruins of old theory. They just developed out of chemistry. So I think Kuhn was wrong. In biology, it's hard to see that what is currently accepted about the circulation of the blood, function of the organs in our body, some aspect of genetics, could be overturned in a new scientific revolution. It will always be true that the heart will pump, the kidneys clean the blood. In physics, the difficulty is physics and Einstein's evolution, which Trevor mentioned. But you can argue that in moving from Newton to Einstein, Newton's theory is a special case for large objects. And the mathematics Newton used is a special case of Einstein. So Einstein made it more precise and applied its speed approaching the speed of light. But the use of terms such as mass and space-time are very different from the two theories. And Einstein completely overturned his belief in absolute space and time. So although there is progress, I think there is very confusing to Einstein, it's hard to support realism in this case. That said, Einstein's theory is surely built on Newton's theory in some sense. You couldn't have jumped straight to Einstein's theory. And the way it's taught is Einstein's theory, you start off looking at Newton, and you don't just go there straight away. And Newton did find it incredible that gravity should act at a distance. So he did the math and he couldn't explain why it worked. And a successful prediction of something like the new planet, Uranus, as a new planet, is a consequence of anomalous observations and the operation of a mathematical inverse square law, rather than any causal theory of gravity. So the inverse square law was good enough to actually show that anomaly. Let's move on and talk a bit about the evolution of scientific theories from an evolutionary standpoint. So, old theories are replaced by new ones, which are better, maybe. They have greater truth likeness, maybe. So Kuhn rejects that account of scientific progress. He says progress consists in terms of science growing with its increased problem solving capacity. And that's certainly true in normal science. And after a revolution, if you think about it, the replacement theory should explain the anomalies as well as the old theory. So the things have increased, the things have progressed. And then also people talk about the new paradigm should be fruitful in terms of knowledge growing. But these sort of views tend to imply some sort of progress towards a goal, some sort of truth, some sort of realism out there. But can we look at the historical succession of theories in an evolutionary light? Theories are continually being made to fit the external world better. It may be possible to apply something like Hegel's theory of the dialectic to competing theories where there's controversy. I don't know, I don't think that's certainly possible that that might fit. But if we've got natural selection, there are two models that science might follow. The first model, we might have two animals, say gazelles and cheetahs, cheetahs hunting the gazelles, the two species evolving in competition with each other. In this case, because they're interacting with each other, the goals are always shifting. Another case would be something like a giraffe evolving to reach the leaves of an acacia tree. If we assume that the trees are at the same height, they don't move, they don't get higher. There's a clear goal that the giraffe has to make, has to get higher and higher. And in science, we're testing theories against evidence. The test always producing the same result, assuming induction and a fixed environment. So science is probably more like this giraffe-like case, where it's against a fixed environment. And it's theoretically possible that theory could reach an optimal fit with the world, or with what we observe in the world. A possible example of that, I would say, is the kinetic theory of gases, which is a very well developed theory. Over time, you can see how it's got more and more precise in time. The last thing I'd like to talk about is a bit about realism, a bit more about realism. So, at the bottom, scientific theories are ultimately models in our heads. They're representations of how the world is, of reality. The problem is, how can that model we have in our heads match that reality? One problem is our experimental results never quite match that perfect reality. And there was a philosopher called Nancy Cartwright who objected to that points never fall on the line. You know, if you do a regression line, you never exactly on the line, are they? So, how come the theory never proves? Because it's never exactly proved. There's not a perfect match. And Kuhn appears to believe that we need an independent access to both theory and reality. And he wrote, the notion of a match between the ontology of a theory and its real counterpart in nature seems to me elusive. So, the existence of a theory, if we might have in our minds, doesn't necessarily match something in reality, in nature. But he may have confused knowledge, he was a Kantian, so he might have confused the sort of this elusive Kantian thing in itself, which we can never know, with what Trevor was talking about, unobservable entities postulated by theory. Now, I would say there is an argument that a theory does provide access to external reality. That's the point of a theory. The problem comes because we only know something about the world via that theory. It may be too small to see, but we can't observe it. But the theory said it's there, like atoms, electrons, and so on. There have been some examples in science where theory has predicted observations which later are confirmed. The classic one is Einstein's theory of light being corpuscular, where the light is bent when it went down the sun. So, in terms of propositional logic, I have a slide here.
What is our time?
Oh, sorry. I'm coming to the end, don't worry. The argument for realism is that P is true if and only P. And where have we got P in the double quotes? P is a statement I make, or someone makes. Like saying, Christ said the world is round. That's a proposition. And it's true only in it. The actual world is round. So if you accept there's an external world outside our minds, then we can make true statements about it. And a theory is like inserting a key into a lock. It unlocks the real nature of things. Now, where isn't there that match? And there probably never is. The world is not exactly the way our theory says it is. Hence we have anomalies, and these are the driving force for progress which Kuhn is talking about. So that's, I don't know, I'd be interested to know what people think of that argument, but it seems to make sense to me.
Yeah.
But, yeah. So in conclusion, just like clear that both Kuhn and Popper thought, I think we all agree, scientific knowledge has increased. Certainly in normal science, things are elaborated over time. Things get more precise. With regard to revolutions, I think things get deeper. So comparing Newton to Einstein, Einstein's theory is obviously much, much deeper. Although I'd have to admit that if you compare his theory to Newton, there's a bit of a powerful case of scepticism if you compare those two theories and what happened when Newton first. But I would say in other sciences, aside from physics, and maybe physics is in some sort of Kuhnian crisis at the moment in terms of quantum science, particle wave theory. Physics does seem to be unusual in that sense. I would say in a science such as chemistry, we do escape this prison of the mind and language. And scientific theories such as the periodic table show not only progress, but they also assert truths about physical reality.
Excellent, Paul, thanks very much. I need to just juggle some things here while Alan is changing the tape. Are there any really burning questions? I'm conscious that time is running a little bit. If it's really burning, ask Paul the question now. So I don't see any hands shooting up. So, David.
I didn't want to ask something about the statement you made here, about the teaching theory being eventual, and yet we know, since it's experiment, the operation of Mercury, in which Newtonian theory and Einstein theory were eventual, if you do the test, you would be true.
Yeah. I think there's possibly two ways in which theories are not comparable. One way is where, if you remember the example of phlogiston and oxygen. So even when scientists were talking about what seemed to be the same thing, they weren't really. There was a mismatch in terms of what they saw. And the same thing about Copernicus, when someone sees the sun rise. You know, some people thought it was the sun moving, other people thought it was the earth moving. So it's a bit like this gestalt thing, you can see different things, even with the same evidence in front of your eyes. The other way is that theories don't emphasize the same thing. So one block of scientists will have a theory looking at A, B, C, D, and the other block of scientists will look at F, G, H, I. And they won't really be talking about the same thing, because they're not talking about the same thing before. So, and they tend to ignore, one group of scientists would ignore what the other group of scientists are talking about. So there's an element of that. But I think you're right. To me, there must be a core part of the theory, which probably could be compared as you go from one theory to another. And as you say, as time goes on, people have somehow incorporated old data into new theories. So I would agree, basically. But couldn't.
Thanks very much.